to the Cigar Thoughts podcast. We are now in the divisional round of the playoffs. I'm your host, Jackson Bevins from fieldgoals.com. With me today, Isaac Williams, Matt Nichols, former all-conference offensive lineman at the Pacific Lutheran University, won a national championship there. By now, you guys know him. Happy to have both of them here. And it's going to be a three-man show today. We're going to start with the Vikings game. I see you wore your Vikings purple with the tie today in memory.
In memorial.
Yep. Another crazy game, right? I mean, it's funny. We'll talk about the specifics of the game in a second. We were chatting before the show, and in the last seven Seahawks playoff games, five of them haven't been decided until the last non-kneeling snap of the game. And I'm trying to think, in my lifetime, if there were five games before Pete Carroll showed up. You know, that's not even counting, like, the Beastquake or any of that, right? But we're getting an incredible amount of drama. And when you look at all of the really astounding finishes in the NFL in big games, whether it be playoff or primetime games, Seahawks play in a staggering amount of those. I mean, it's really an amazing thing to be treated to or susceptible to as a fan. And we got another one. Isaac, I want to start with you. What were your takeaways when that game was over, and after you kind of processed the weirdness of the ending, you look back on it, what stands out?
Well, it was a remarkable game to just watch, be a part of. It was such a weird game. I mean, I think in most seasons where teams, if they go to the Super Bowl, if they go to the NFC Championship or whatever it is, there's going to be a game that you got to figure out and get by. You know, and if that was the Packers last year or whatever it was for us. But you just got to – the elements were a wild card, and it was just one of those. And to kudos to the Seahawks for overcoming all that stuff, getting themselves into position where they needed some help to end up winning at the end of the day. But, and just completely weak-kneed and, you know, the gamut of emotions and just spent and tuckered out and thrilled and, you know, it was like the Super Bowl, but not as bad. It was like Atlanta the years earlier. It was that exuberant, you know, just being so excited and then being grateful there was so little time left that nothing else could happen, hopefully.
You know? Yeah. Seriously. Seriously. Yeah. How about you, Matt?
You know, when they took that kneel down, and I'm standing in my family room. My wife is there. My kids are all celebrating. We have friends that are over. Mm-hmm. And I look at our friend Todd, and I'm like, how the hell did we win this game? Mm-hmm. And it was just one of those that you're like, they did just enough. It was the skin of their teeth. It was that 2% we've talked about where they had done all of those little things throughout the games where Minnesota had their three scoring drives. They had, 23 plays for 51 yards? They had done those kind of things in the first, second, and third quarter that allowed them to be in a position that when Walsh had to have to kick a nail-biting field goal. Again, in those elements, as bad as it was, and even Pete Carroll's talked about this, we're not going to go back and look at the film for execution and stuff like that. We're looking at heart. We're looking at how guys fought and battled, and we're moving on. And playing in a game that's been cold but not nearly that cold, it's kind of what you do because everything slows down. Your body never gets loose. Players never get to full speed. It's just different. It's like playing in quicksand or playing in mud where it didn't look like an NFL game speed-wise at all on the TV.
Talk about that for a second.
Yeah.
Because so much of the talk leading up to the game had to do with the weather. Mm-hmm. And us plebeian folks can make, you know, assumptions about how cold affects a player, but you guys have done it, right? And I think there's a specific game where you guys played in extreme cold. What is it like? How does it change? How did it change what you guys do? How did it change what a quarterback does, receivers, tacklers? If you guys could talk about that for a bit.
Yeah, so, and again, when we talk about extreme cold, Isaac and I had a playoff game in college our senior year that was probably between 15 to 20 degrees. So this is still 20 to 25 degrees colder than that. For me, I never felt loose. I never felt in rhythm. I never felt comfortable. Like, it just, everything just seemed off a little bit. And you know, kind of when you get up in the morning and get ready to go to work and you realize you have brushed your teeth and you're like, ah, everything's off.
Yeah.
It kind of felt like that where you're just not there. Yeah. As a center, I remember having to grab the ball a little bit differently. I remember the longer we played, and the NFL is very different than college because we don't have nearly as many balls that get rotated in and out. But I remember them getting a little bit harder and just having to adjust the way I gripped it to shotgun snap. It got, you'd have to move my hand, I'd have to move my hand up towards the tip of the ball a little bit more. And I just remember, like, it doesn't hurt more, like, the hits don't hurt more. But you're not able to explode into a hit like you normally do. Sure. You just don't have that feeling.
Is that the same for you?
Yeah, it's just kind of like having it's just like playing in molasses is what it's like. You know, everything slows down. You don't get to have the stuff you love. You can't. I mean, I was a tackle. I never touched the ball once in that game. You know, but I would suspect. I mean, it would be like, you don't get to catch the ball and feel it the way you want to. The ball's not going to come at you the speed you're used to. You're not going to be able to run a route the way you want to do it. You're not going to be... I do remember about that game, obviously, footing for us, at least in that game, was an issue. I don't actually remember being that cold. Now, granted, this game was 20 degrees colder, but, you know, pads are warm. You know, you've got... God bless the guys in their bare sleeves and all that stuff.
Sure.
And the, you know, coming out in polo shirts and pregame and all that.
Yeah, yeah.
But, as long as I was active, it's not that I was warm, but at the same time I was okay. It would have been rough to be a fan. It would have been rough to have to come in and snap, to have to come in and hold.
Yeah.
Those are things where, you know, or come in on sets. If I'm a receiver that plays on third and long or something like that, where I'm sitting there in my sideline jacket and all of a sudden then I got to go in and perform. I had the blessing of being at a constant activity level.
Sure.
Which was a lot more comfortable. So those guys, I mean, big kudos to the snappers, the holders, the punters, you know, folks that have to sit there and they get five or six big plays a game, Blair Walsh, where that'd be chilly, man. I'd be camped out in front of the jet warmer and, you know.
Totally. Well, and I think you bring up those guys that bring that play five or six plays a game, and you said Blair Walsh. But, I mean, even look at Clint Grisham's couple of snaps weren't the greatest. Their snaps by the Minnesota long snapper, they were up and in.
Yeah.
Those guys could do that stuff in their sleep. They could be blindfolded, snap it, and there's not an issue.
Which I can tell you, for having snapped a little bit, wasn't good at it, but there was nobody else, and thank gosh somebody else came eventually. You know, if you're uncomfortable and you're out of your element or the ball's really wet or it's super duper cold, you know, you're trying to think of the lesser of all evils. All right, if I'm really worried that I'm going to uncork one or something's going to go wrong, I want to snap it at his body so at least I snap it off of him versus 30 yards downfield. Or if I'm going to long snap, I don't want to snap it over his head. I want to bury it below his knees so at least he can bend down and get it and have a chance versus snapping it over his head. And so I could really I felt for Clint Grisham in those first series of snaps. Just because I don't know if it was cold or whatever, those were low, and I don't know if that was him overcompensating, trying to say I don't want to snap this thing 20 yards and just gross motor it down the field, or was he just trying to be delicate? Because it was again, it was like being in molasses and never being loose and out of your comfort zone. And
well, then you get to a point too where your hands don't function normally.
Yeah.
Like you can't feel them. You can't get a good grip where you like if you grab a wrench you can feel it, but you grab a wrench outside when it's been in the cold and then your hands are cold, you start to lose the ability to grip it tight.
My brother-in-law is a firefighter, but he does EMT stuff, and he had said around 0 degrees you have about 60% of your grip strength.
Wow.
And so if you think about that, quarterbacks throwing the ball, snapper snapping the ball, physiologically it really. You know, we're doing it on the line. There's delicate stuff, but it's a lot of gross motor. You're pushing and pulling. Where those guys that have to be dexterous and, you know, that's a big deal.
Let me say real quick. It's 2016. We should not be playing games in this anymore. Like, if you want to romanticize the Bronco Nagurski era of playing in the freezing cold, they didn't have the option of not doing it, right?
Yeah.
Like, it was – these were garbage men and, you know, and sales reps and stuff that played football. And
yeah.
You know, they were building a sport. But nowadays, like, I don't know. I don't know what the alternative is.
No.
Give everyone an indoor stadium. But, like, that game didn't tell us who the better football team was.
No.
It didn't.
No.
And no one can – like, I think the more talented team advanced, but I don't think you can say the team that played the best necessarily advanced. There's no way to tell it. And one of the things – and it's funny because looking back – if I had taken the time to think about when I had been the coldest and the challenges that that faces or that brings about, speaking is one of them. And I never considered that. And Russell Wilson talked after the game. He was having a hard time getting his mouth to make the right movements and to make the right calls.
Yep.
And in hindsight, that made so much sense why they were so late getting out of the huddle and so late adjusting to the line calls. Because we had talked about how on schedule they'd been, how Daryl Bevel was 2-3 play calls ahead because he knows his guys have the play call and they're ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
But when you think about it, what that's like to try and communicate that when you're having a hard time, your jaw is frozen, right? I mean, that's interesting. Now, granted, the Vikings didn't seem to have any troubles with that. Not that I was watching it that closely.
No, I think there's also a thing where Pete has talked about the communication issues with headsets not working properly, and the farther away from midfield they got towards the end zones, the more it would go in and out, so Russell would have to wait because he would hear the play call, but he wouldn't hear the protection, or he would hear part of the play call and then nothing else. And so,
that's because what I'm saying. We just shouldn't.
Well, and if we want to romanticize football about being played in the elements, all of that. When was the last time we've actually had a Super Bowl that has not been in a warm weather city?
Right.
I mean, it's going to be Santa Clara this year. It was in New York. Isaac was at that Super Bowl, and a snowstorm hit the following day. But it's only in New York because it's in New York City. It's not because it's in Minnesota or Green Bay or
Minnesota's hosted Super Bowls, but in the Metrodome.
But it's the NFL doesn't want elements to be part of it because they don't put their biggest game of the year in elements. Right. If it was that important, they would do it in there, but they don't.
Well, and here's the thing. I mean, no one's tuning in for that, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there might be some casual interest in seeing what a game is like in 10 inches of snow or 20 below wind chill or whatever it is, but you're not seeing. I mean, we watch NFL football because we're watching the best in the world be the best in the world, right? That's the draw.
Yes.
That's the draw.
Or for me as a Seahawks fan, I don't mind if it's the Cleveland Browns versus the Jaguars. Then I'm like, sweet, let them play in a foot of snow. I don't care. But if it's my Seahawks, it's something that matters.
In a playoff game.
And $140 million worth of players out on the field for each team. So you got a quarter of $1 billion worth
just
of athletes.
Just in talent. Just in the talent.
On the field. Yeah. And we're going to put them in the and again, this is one of those offshoots because they're building a stadium,
sure,
and it'll be there. I mean, this
product
is a non-issue.
Circumstance.
This is a non-issue next year, but in 2 weeks from now, this could be a Lambeau issue.
Sure,
very good. I mean, the Packers have the way they played. They could go into Arizona, knock them off, and be hosting Seattle. Seattle's fortunate enough to get by Carolina, so it could be elements again.
It turns into the Drew Stanton show. I mean, that's.
Yeah,
I mean, it could be a Packers victory with Carson Palmer over them.
Yeah,
really quickly.
But it was amazing how the Seahawks just overcame and overcame and overcame and put themselves in a position that Blair Walsh had to kick a very pressure-filled field goal. And again, the whole laces thing. Laces don't mean a hill of beans on a 27-yard field goal. That's a lazy person's argument. Laces make a big difference when you're kicking for distance.
Which you hit the one with the laces.
Yeah,
from like 46.
Yeah. The laces don't mean anything. It's unfortunate. He just or fortunate, but he just shanked it. He just flat missed.
It was unfortunate that it happened. I'm glad it worked out in Sal's favor. That's
absolutely. And again, you think about like big missed field goals and stuff.
As a sports fan, you don't like to see a person's failure be the center of the outcome of the game.
Yeah, and he did. He sat there in his locker, he answered every question after the game. I mean, there's a 30 for 30 going on right now about the Bills, and talked about Scott Norwood for over an hour after the Super Bowl, sitting there and answering every single question. I mean, your heart aches for the guy.
The throw to Diggs, where Earl Thomas came over and knocked. I mean, that throw is 4 inches shorter, or Earl Thomas gets there a quarter of a second later. Blair Walsh might not be even having a kick.
And here's the thing. Blair Walsh is the only guy that put any points on the board.
It's exactly,
you know, like, he's gonna, you can get real angry at Blair Walsh for that, but if that field goal had happened on any of his first three, you'd talk about it, but it wouldn't be the focal point,
right?
We
hit Baldwin for a touchdown earlier in the game. Christian Michaels runs 70 yards untouched on the run play. It's never an issue. Blair Walsh... It's like
touchdowns Bill Buckner, win football games.
It's like Bill Buckner.
Touchdowns win football games. Field goals are consolation prizes. Mm-hmm. Touchdowns win football
games. And that's why Seahawks have been so good, is because people are able to move the ball, but right. they force them to kick field goals.
Yes.
And this has been a reoccurring theme for 4 years
Did
now.
Did you know that this was the seventh game this season that the Seahawks didn't allow an offensive touchdown? Seven out of 17 games.
Well, and the Vikings have had two games against the Seahawks in which they haven't scored an offensive touchdown. I mean, the Cordell Patterson touchdown return is the only touchdown that they've had. So 120 minutes of football, their offense has had the ball, what, 21, 22 drives? And they couldn't get a... They couldn't get.
I got some numbers for you. In the two games against Minnesota this year, in two games, the Vikings have 308 yards on 104 plays and 9 offensive points. 2.9 yards per play over two games. Not a fluky, things went our way and they got off script. That happens. Two games, less than 3 yards per play.
It's like Linfield. If they get an offense, we're all in trouble.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Sure. No, it's and against the best running back in the National Football League.
Yeah. I mean, he now has 31 carries for 63 yards in two games against the Seahawks.
Well, and less than two.
I mean,
yeah.
Less than two.
Adrian Peterson.
2 yards carry.
They made him look bad.
Yeah.
I mean, they made him look bad.
I will say, I thought this was their best tackling game. Sure. I can remember, especially considering the elements and how much it hurts your fingers. You got to grab a jersey and hang on while a helmet hits it and all of that stuff, right?
Yeah.
I thought they tackled so well. And there was a play in particular, there the tackle. Obviously, Richard Sherman had a couple of great tackles. Earl Thomas had a couple of great tackles.
Absolutely.
But the best tackle of the game, in my opinion, was KJ Wright standing up Adrian Peterson on the swing pass that allowed Cam Chancellor come in and forces a fumble.
Yes.
And what Cam Chancellor did was amazing. What Atiba Rubon did to get down 20 yards downfield as a D tackle and jump on the ball like immediately.
Mm-hmm.
But KJ Wright hit Adrian Peterson and stood him straight up.
Yep. Well, and if you look at that too, as well as standing him up, he pins his left arm behind him, so Adrian has no chance to help cover the ball with his other. You can physically see he has his arm pinned, which is, as part of group tackling, you are taught to remove arms from around the ball and separate the ball from the body. Unbelievable. And it happens that fast, too. I thought one of the best plays of the game, they tried to run Adrian Peterson around the left side, and Bruce Irvin stoned his guy and kept outside contained.
Mm-hmm.
They just did all of these little things that always get overlooked.
To give credit to Bruce Irvin, man, I was hard on Bruce Irvin.
I love
that
Bruce.
That guy has become, you know, and just...
Bruce is my
just
guy.
Become a darn good football player.
Mm-hmm. I hope that the Marshawn money that gets freed up, I hope some of that goes to Bruce.
Should,
I love that dude.
He's worked hard at his craft. He's gone from, you know, the athleticism, and he's worked it, and he's just become a darn good, incredibly athletic, and just good for Bruce.
Well, honestly, if you had to, like, decide a football game Greek style where you send out a champion, you might send out Bruce over Cam.
Especially this year.
He's a bad dude.
Well, think about what a good pass rusher he is on third downs, and then he came into this league with incredible athletic ability and very little refined skills, and now he's a very good Sam linebacker, and his pass drops are good. Him running with tight ends is very good. Him running with Anquan Boldin in the first game with the Niners. I mean, step for step with him.
Yep. Dude, we got some dudes.
There's some dogs in that pen, man.
Dudes.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. I think that it's little things, right? Especially when a game is decided by 1 point. Any single play could be the difference, right? Mm-hmm. That game doesn't have drama if what's-his-name doesn't grab Christian Michael's foot on a play. And we'll talk about that in the next segment when we get a little bit more X's and O's-ier. But, you know, it's little stuff like that. There's, you know, Earl Thomas is, like you said, one step later on that seam route.
Yep.
And we've got a totally different ballgame, right? So it's little things. And so often on 98% of plays, there is a tackle or, you know, whatever. Incomplete passes, whatever. But you get a lot of tackles. And the difference in a game might be 4 missed tackles versus 5 missed tackles, right? And that's threshold for Pete Carroll. He thinks that 5 and above missed tackles in a game correlates with loss. 5 and under, you know, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's little stuff like that that's not in the box score that we don't pay attention to when we're watching.
Yep.
So to have a team show up in elements that are not contact friendly and tackle that well, I thought mattered a great deal.
Yep.
think that the main takeaway for me in this game, and it's unfortunate, it shouldn't be the main takeaway. There's a lot of other things that I think are more important than this, but I can't help coming back to the fact that I still don't have any more confidence in this defense to hold a lead. I mean, this is a team that could not score a touchdown on them in 20-plus drives this season. Mm-hmm. Taking over, I mean, it was a pretty good field position, but not great. Their own 30-something, right, on that last drive. Mm-hmm. And, okay, there was a probably wrong pass interference mm-hmm. call in there. But on the very next thing, Kyle Rudolph, who didn't have a catch all day, right? Seattle's finally defending the tight end. And he breaks off a 24-yarder on, like, a peewee football route, right? That kind of thing has me still worried. I've only really considered them to have held a lead against a competent NFL quarterback one time in this game. That was the Steelers game. You know, yes, they did it against the Cardinals, but, I mean, that wasn't game-on-the-line stuff, right? Even the Lions game, where they technically held that lead, I mean, the defense didn't really. I mean, there was a miracle play.
We were
playing
the ball out of the back of the end zone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And a miracle play, that's right.
So, let me ask you guys this. You have to bet $1,000 on this scenario. $1,000 cash, okay? Comes straight out of your kids' college fund.
Real.
Yeah. $1,000. Carolina has the ball down to 1.5 minutes left. One timeout, own 30-yard line. You're betting $1,000. Did the Seahawks win that game?
So if they're at their own 30-yard line, that means they got to get to the 35 for a 52-yard field goal.
Yeah, assuming decent conditions.
So they got 20, 15. They got 35 yards to go in 90 seconds. Mm-hmm. It's not that hard to go 35 yards in 90 seconds. I mean, that's a play or two. Mm-hmm. I think one of the things that happens with Seattle's defense, and again, they're the best scoring defense in the NFL, and we've kind of been spoiled by how good they are. Mm-hmm. But in those situations, it takes away the run. The run teams aren't going to run there because then they have to use their timeout immediately. So it puts them in a passing situation. And Seattle's, as good as the LOB is, that cover three is designed where everything is underneath and then we're going to make tackles. And you're not going to beat us with a 70-yard touchdown pass to go up five in that situation. But you can dink and dunk cover three all day long, as we saw Tom Brady do in the Super Bowl, where he was just patient enough, and then as soon as Averill was out and Jeremy Lane had been out for a while, in the fourth quarter he gets two long touchdown drives. So, in
let
that situation...
Let me move that to 4 points.
Okay.
Take the field goal out of it.
We don't even know if he'll bet the $1,000. Wait, what? Is he bet the
$1,000? Well, I got three kids, so which one's losing it out of their college fund?
All three of them, equally.
No, if a team has to go 35 yards for a field goal attempt...
The Panthers against the
Seahawks.
Okay,
if the Panthers have to go 35 yards for a field goal attempt at 90 yards, my money is, because I'm a Seahawks fan, will be on the Seahawks. I'm going to have a horrible pit in my stomach the whole time. If a team has to go 65 yards for a touchdown, I don't think they're going to have a communication issue like they did with Greg Olsen for the touchdown. Yep. I would feel very confident wagering it for the touchdown.
That's exactly what I was going to say. If they had to go 35 yards and kick a field goal, I wouldn't bet the $1,000. If they had to score a touchdown now, I would be willing.
You think?
Yeah, well, I could lose, but I wouldn't bet $1,000 that they could hold them off in the field. I mean, I love the Seahawks and I mm-hmm. lead Seahawks.
I'm just saying, like, but you're betting that hopefully, right? Like, you're not, these guys got this.
My love and affinity for the Seahawks out of it.
Yes.
Any NFL team, if they only had to go 35 yards with whatever the time was at one timeout.
35 yards in 90 seconds is not hard to do. Nope. I mean, the reality is it's probably two plays because the defense is so worried about getting beat deep that you can run those 18-yard dig routes. Yeah. You run two of those, and there's your 36 yards, game, set, match. Unless it's Blair Walsh kicking. But no, I mean, in all seriousness, 35 yards is not hard to get, especially when you're like, we got to get 35 yards or this game's over. You get flowing a little bit, and you get in a two-minute pace where a defense can't substitute in, and they don't have time to regroup and to get, you know, catch their breath and to get new signals in or new players in. At the end of the game, the defenders are always more tired than the offensive guys. Yeah. Playing defense is harder than playing offense from a conditioning standpoint because everything is reactionary.
There's a reason you don't sub out offensive linemen, right?
That's exactly
right. You sub out D linemen all day long.
Yep, exactly. Yeah.
and God made them superior. But we don't say that out loud. No. Though with the 4-point thing, 70 yards and 4 points or whatever it was, I would want to throw up, but I would be much more willing to bet $1,000 that it. Yeah, that's a lot harder.
Yeah,
it's a lot because you get into the end zone and the compression of and space, lack of space.
But okay, so we're talking about this. Well, we'll get to this later because I want to revisit that. I would say that Carolina is, like, I think far and away the most efficient red zone team in the NFL. Mm-hmm. Right, like they have the best red zone weapon that's probably ever existed in the game of football, at least since Jim Brown, probably.
Yeah.
So, but we'll get to that. I think that Carolina is a team that specifically can beat what Seattle tries to make you do in that situation. Mm-hmm. Sure. But I think that to kind of close the book on the Vikings game, there's been a lot of talk about who deserved to win. Did the Seahawks get lucky? Or the way I see it, every single NFL game features 140 plays of 22 dudes being asked to do dynamic, challenging tasks that require an insane amount of critical thinking and physiological ability against an all-world physical mm-hmm. opponent. Mm-hmm. There's just shit's going to go sideways sometimes. Yeah. Like, it's just going to happen. So I think that there's a lot more luck in football than a lot of people want to admit. So, you know, an obvious example of luck is just that. It's an obvious example of something that happens 100 times during a football game. And feel free to disagree with me. You guys played longer than I did. But for me, deserved has nothing to do with it, right? You make your own luck, and then what you do with that luck is up to you.
Yes.
And the Seahawks, when 20 years of Seahawks fandom got distorted and warped by a 5-touchdown Super Bowl win, mm-hmm. before that, it took this much room on a tipped ball in the end zone when it looked for all the world like the 49ers were going to just march down the field and win that game, right?
Yep.
So they can turn this narrow win when the environment is crazy and things are going all funky. It's kind of like the Rams game. It's like I said on this podcast after the Rams game, is it doesn't really change who I think this team is. Mm-hmm. Nothing that I saw in that game makes me think about the Seahawks differently moving forward. They basically won a coin flip of a game, and I think that hopefully the conditions in Carolina allow us to see the best team win.
You know, I'm not so much of a believer in luck in games because I don't believe it was luck that the center for the Rams chased after the ball and recovered those fumbles on two situations.
Okay.
That was hustle. I don't think it's luck at all, but Ruben catches up and gets the fumble because he's busted his ass. We've seen it all year long. I mean, think back to the Cleveland game when him and Mebane tackle the running back on a screen play 25 yards down the field. That's the luck thing, I'm not a big believer in it. I think Pete said it really well when he said fortune. They put themselves in a position to have that. Again, in those conditions, you just try to survive. You try to get the win, and you get the hell out of there, and you move on, and you don't worry about what the how the plays broke down or all that. You just try to get on. I'm not a big believer, though, in luck. I really believe, and again, going back to who deserves it more, I think that's an absolute garbage topic that people talk about. How do you know who played harder than the others, right, or who deserved it more? It's like when you see people make comments online about, oh, he can't read a defense. Well, how the hell do you know if he can't read a defense? Maybe that had worked on that play all week long, and that quarterback just jumped the route because he had worked on that route combination all week long too. I don't believe in who's more deserving.
No, that's good. I'm glad. Like I say, you guys played a lot longer than I did, so. I mean, you know what the ins and outs
look like. I would give a great deal of credit to the Seahawks that when it was 9-0 at a time when it was very uncomfortable and things could have gotten away.
What a gross feeling that was at that point in the game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they've shown time and time again that if they're behind, they can come back, and they're very good at getting into situations where breaks can go our way and we win. And to their credit, they found a way back in. They found a way to get ahead where that could happen. It's regrettable that they got into a situation where somebody had to have a breakdown, for lack of a better way of saying it, for us to win. Mm-hmm. I think the goal as an athlete and as a team would always be to get into a situation where the referees and the other team can't beat you. You've gotten, you've executed well enough so that things out of your control can't beat you. And the challenge is this was the kind of game where it was within that margin where things out of your control would beat you. And basically we got to the brink of that and things went our way. And sometimes you play a game and things get out of control and you're sunk. But
sure.
You know, that's I would just put this thing to bed. I'm so glad we got away with it. I'm glad the breaks went our way.
Yeah.
And I think if this turns into a magical season, you got to get through something just bloody and awful. Like that.
Yeah. And I think let's go back to luck. The thing about the snap that goes over and Russell Wilson's.
Luck can be you if he throws for 3 touchdowns.
Andrew.
It was there. It was there. I had to take.
No, but think about that snap that goes over Russell Wilson's shoulder. It's not lucky that he...
No.
It's not lucky that his offensive linemen continue to block.
Probably
it's
my
not,
favorite play of the
it's
season.
It's not lucky that he has a baseball background and does an unbelievable hook slide.
You're right.
Pops up, dekes the corner or whoever the safety is that's coming. It's not luck that Tyler Lockett realizes what's going on and runs to an open space of the field. It's not luck that Jermaine doesn't block a guy in the back. I mean, those aren't luck things. Those are things that happen because when shit breaks down and it gets awful, the real resourceful people become really resourceful.
And it's not luck that their corner or DB or whoever was chase Lockett down and tackled him on the 4-yard line.
Yes.
You know, we could have fumbled or thrown a pick or gone 3 and out or kicked a field goal. You got to give it to that guy because he, you know, there's people made plays and it was, yeah, it was hard work and being aware and not giving up and grinding.
Yeah. And, you know, like I said, that was my favorite play of the game. It was one of my favorite plays of the season, if not. In a game that's 10-9, I think that it's easier to identify some real linchpin plays than a game that's 39-30, right? What were some of the ones that stood out to you guys the most? And Isaac, I want to start with you on this. When you think back on that game and you think about plays that to you stood out as difference makers, was there one? Was there two?
Sure. I think there are some big ones we'll get to, but I'll start with the snap and the John Ryan nose break, punt scamper. You know, the ways that could have gone. It's interesting. I would think a punter probably has an internal clock in his head, and he probably could have caught that and kicked it in the end without issue, realizing the conditions slowed everybody else down. But his timer, which is 90-degree timer or 60-degree timer or whatever, it was still the same speed even though it was zero. What happens if he goes left instead of trying to jump over the pile of bodies? You know, maybe he gets that first down. Maybe Minnesota doesn't even kick the first field goal. We score a touchdown on that drive, and it ends up being 27-3.
Sure.
You know, it gets out of hand at that point.
So crazy to think about it that way.
Isn't that funny? But, I mean, so if you're Minnesota and it's that temperature and we somehow march down and score a touchdown and then come down a drive later and kick a field goal and it's 10-0, and all of a sudden it's not 9-0 Minnesota, it's 10-0 Seahawks, and they go, oh, my gosh, here we go again. Totally different outcome. Yeah. So that was one where it was an interesting play. It was a pivotal time in the game. You know, it just a lot of things could have happened differently on that play. I think that was a big one. You know, another big one. It was just the feed on the television was really good. That play where you know, Matt can break it down a little bit more. Where Kristen Michael ended up. I mean, they showed the
rear
view.
Oh my gosh! I thought he was gone.
The parting of the seas.
It was like,
man, Michael, I thought he was gone.
There was a chance one linebacker might have played over the top and got into the play, but it was like him in a 5-foot hole and 70 yards. And, you know, that was one of those where I went, okay, that play goes differently.
Tell me about that one.
Huge plays.
Again, same formation that they busted the play a couple of weeks ago where they had the stacked receivers, Kristen Michael, same read option look. And
we talked about that.
Well, and again, we don't know if it's a read option or not because they could be calling these handoffs and Russell boots, so it looks like a read option. They have two different calls for this. Again, handoff to Kristen Michaels. It's open. The line does a beautiful job sealing guys off, and I don't remember who the D end is that just literally shoots his arm down there and trips him up, and that's a game-saving chance. I mean, that's a minimum 40-yard run, sure, like the previous week.
Absolutely.
And that's a huge game-changer. I thought, for me, the play of the game was we have the botch snapped. Get the ball down to the 4-yard line, try to run it, doesn't work, throw the touchdown to Baldwin, come back, Adrian Peterson reception, fumble. We try the shot play to Lockett.
Yep.
We try a run. It's not there. It's that 3rd and 7 conversion to Jermaine Kearse. Which would have been a 55-yard field goal, which Hauschka can't kick.
You can't do
in
it
those
in
conditions.
Nope.
You cannot kick it in those conditions. Jermaine Kearse runs an 8-yard route, makes an unbelievably strong hands catch on a little stick route, gets tackled, falls down, and it's first down. And now we have a manageable field goal kick. That is the play of the game, because that allowed Hauschka to kick that 46 or 47 yarder. And that's everything that's not luck. That is making your own way. He had a defender on him.
Yep.
Russell threw a 95-mile-an-hour fastball to him. And he just caught it beautifully, gets tackled
and
immediately.
It is to Jermaine Kearse's credit how he has developed as a wide receiver. Mm-hmm. Because as recently as this time last year, he was still a body catcher. I mean, you saw it in the NFL or in the NFC Championship game when, you know, basically you could argue that 3 of the interceptions were on Jermaine Kearse. And that last one just bouncing off of his chest, right? Yep. I mean, he was a bodies catcher. He didn't trust his hands. That catch that he made on that play was as good of a trust your hands catch as you'll ever see in conditions that are as anti-trust your hands as possible. Mm-hmm. Like you say, a short-range fastball.
Yeah.
I mean, coming in super hot, and he didn't just catch it with his hands. He never brought it to his body.
Yeah.
He caught it, and that ball stuck. No matter how much it hurts your fingers, no matter how much less feel you have, how hard the ball is, how slick the ball is, mm-hmm. to stick it and swing it across the first down marker, yep. You're right. I think that was the play of the whole football game.
Think about that, too. How many plays the offense had been on the field in that time period? So you have going back prior to the snap over Russell's head. They had a little bit of a drive going. So they've been on the field for that chunk of change. They're off the field for the kickoff, the 2 Adrian Peterson plays, and then they're back on the field. It's not like they had time to warm back up. And again, with the NFL, there's TV timeouts and stuff. But that was hands that are frozen, fourth quarter, not feeling much. And he stuck that like nobody's business.
Oh, man, that was an amazing catch. And I remember thinking in the first play of the game that he had a chance to make a catch on an out, or first series anyway, on an out route. And it bounced off his hands. And I'm thinking, bad Jermaine's here. But you guys pointed out something that I think is really crucial. And Isaac, what was that?
Well, it was weird, and I don't know why it caught. When the game started, I had realized just that Sun was so brutal. It was a Seahawks sideline, I think. Seahawks were in the shade, Vikings were in the sun. Mm-hmm. And I was really surprised that they ran that first route of the game into the Viking sideline with the sun really just blasting them in the face. I mean, temperature aside, it's just often I can think of lots of offensive coordinators not necessarily wanting to run a route into the sun where the quarterback's throwing the ball into the sunshine. I would think, you know...
Just an oversight on Darrell Bevell's part?
I don't know. I mean, there's probably... Who knows? I wasn't on the field. I have no idea how the field played. I have no idea. I can't, for the moment... I don't know if it was the short side of the field or the long side of the field. There's a lot that goes into that. I was just surprised because usually you'd want the quarterback looking into the sun and the receiver not.
You talked about at PLU how Scott Western, your offensive coordinator, would check out the sun before a game. Not something I ever think to look at. But you say even in practice, if they want to run a certain play.
Yeah, if we were going to run a play and we knew it was a pass play in which the receiver is going to have to look back into it, we would sometimes flip the field. So if it's 3:30 in the afternoon, the sun's up there, and the receiver would have to turn around and look back into the sun, we're going to flip the field 90 degrees so quarterback can throw it, receiver can see it, and so we can at least practice it.
So instead of forcing that receiver to get over it and make that play in the sun, they're saying, we're just not going to call that play if the sun's in the receiver's eyes.
We're going to put you in the most advantageous position to be successful. Yeah. And if you're not looking into the sun and getting blinded by that big thing up in the sky is advantageous, we're not going
to
do that.
Well, I mean, they would say, if we have to call on you, we'll call the play into it. I believe you can catch it. But if I can hold a quarter till we flip the field and run the play, let's try it then. Or let's run it into the other boundary. So you're not having to fight that battle. I'm a good offensive coordinator, what I would say to my player is, I believe you can catch it looking into the sun. And if we have to, we'll run it into the sun. But that being said, in my mind, I would say, if I can hold on this play until I have the quarterback looking into the sun, throwing it to the receiver, not looking into the sun, I would much rather have that happen.
Sure. Yeah. And I think if you look at dynamics within practices, too, and the way coaches or people talk to others, we had some smart coaches that they would make sure they were the ones looking into the sun mm-hmm. when they were addressing the team, as sure. opposed to the 100 guys looking into the sun. Mm-hmm. Because the second you get 100 guys looking into the sun, eyes go down, ears close off, you're not paying attention. It's not about you can't do it, but it's about putting you in the best possible position Absolutely. To succeed.
And then, of course, we can overanalyze it. Maybe they called the play and they were like, oh, my God, he's going to have to look right into the sun. Oh, well.
Yeah.
You can right. you can overthink this stuff.
Yeah, sure. Or the play was in sure. was the first play of the script sure. on Friday, and yeah. they didn't know exactly where the sun would I mean, yeah. sure. all of those things play a huge difference. Or Russell's read was to one side, and that was taken away by the defense.
But I can definitely say there's been a lot of plays at PLU where they would hold, and they would hold a play until the field flipped at the quarter and then run it the next quarter simply because they didn't like, you know, especially if it's has the potential of being a big play, they want to give it the most chance to succeed. And that can be elements, that can be as much as a fall game where there's frost on one part of the field in the shade and sun on another part of the field and it's melted.
Yeah.
And saying, nope, we want to run it to this side versus that side and let's hold.
Takes too much effort. All coordinators are either geniuses or idiots.
It's just fire Daryl Bevel.
Fire Daryl Bevel. That's right. Just keep in mind things that need to be considered that we don't even think about before we criticize play calling, right? Okay. We're anti-play calling criticism here.
Yeah.
Not that you should never do it, but, you know, pick your spots. Only one touchdown scored in this game. There was one touchdown for everything that went down and all the craziness. Only one time did a team get the ball in the end zone. And Matt, you pointed out something about that play to me, actually, shortly after the game. If you could kind of run us through that.
Yeah, so I thought it was a really cool play design. So oftentimes when you see isolation, one-man routes in an end zone, it's a fade route. Like, that is the 6'5" receiver, throw it up to him, let him make a play, get 2 feet in, get pushed out of bounds, touchdown. This was an isolation play to Doug Baldwin in which the cornerback is sitting in an outside position. Let's go back pre-snap again. Russell's back in shotgun. He's got running back to his side. There's Kearse and Baldwin on the right-hand side, and Kearse is the far receiver out there. He motions across the field. Chase Kaufman's in a tight end position, and then Tyler Lockett is the far receiver on the left. With Kearse's motion across, we realize immediately that it's man coverage because that outside corner has contracted down a little bit, and as opposed to following Kearse across, he contracted down, takes Baldwin as the number one receiver, and the inside nickel goes across the field and runs with Jermaine. So you see linebackers flip. You know that they're in more of a man coverage there. It might be a man zone, but it's more of a man concept. The cornerback that's sitting there is the third cornerback, and I don't remember his last name, Robinson or something. I mean, I don't remember. He's sitting with an outside shade on Doug Baldwin, and so he immediately, you see, he is looking to take away that big chunk of real estate that Doug has sure. to work with. Doug runs at him, makes an incredible shifty move where the cornerback's hips get flat, they square up, and at that point, Doug cuts outside, and he's about a yard and a half.
If you're even, he's leaving.
Yeah, and he's about and he is about a yard and a half into the end zone, and as he's coming back and makes the catch, he's only about a half a yard in, so he's working his way back towards the pylon. The throw by Russell, again, is a 100-mile-an-hour fastball because he's got to get rid of it. They move the pocket a little to the right, so it shortens the throw, but it also makes Russell more, he's not sitting in the pocket, so it cuts down the length of the throw. Plus, allows him to get moving and get his shoulders turned towards it. The thing that I thought was really cool about it is oftentimes on the goal line, when you see a 3-by-1 set, and this has become a 3-by-1 set because Kearse motioned across, defenses think they're going to go to the 3 side because there are more options over there. And Jermaine Baldwin is not a guy that you're going to throw a jump ball to.
I mean, they will. I don't think it's ever worked, but they've done it a lot.
Yeah. But it's one of the things where you look at the numbers, and the numbers say they're probably going to go to the left. And a brilliant play call, a brilliant, just a, again, Doug Baldwin being an amazing, amazing route runner, and we have sold him short on how good he is.
He has become phenomenal.
Excellent.
He has become an excellent wide receiver.
Yes.
We haven't even talked about the catch yet, but we will. But I want to know, on a play like that, your second and goal, you don't want a third and goal play call right there, right? That becomes an extremely high leverage play when you're down 9-0.
Exactly.
Right? Now you're thinking, are we going for it on fourth, right? So that second down play call, you really want to save yourself that. Mm-hmm. So my question, actually, either of you guys, feel free to answer. I just looked at you because you brought it up, but it seems since they moved the pocket right, since they forced an isolation route on the right side, is that do or die to Doug Baldwin? Is that Doug Baldwin is open or I throw it away? Because as I'm re-picturing it in my mind, I don't see him with a second read on that play.
With Russell's ability to run and escape, there's always a backup plan.
There's a hope.
Think back to Luke Wilson's two-point conversion in the NFC Championship. Crazy. Where, again, they're moving to the right.
Crazy.
It's not there. He throws it back to the left. Is there a chance? Yes. That play is designed, though, to go to Doug on the right side.
That's a one-read play.
My two cents on this whole thing would be, I think there were a couple subtle things that were really remarkable about that touchdown. A, they moved the pocket, because without moving the pocket, it probably allows that guy to get back into the play and screw everything up, the defensive back. Secondly, that linebacker with Russell's ability to run, in essence, the outside linebacker, if you watch it, really, if that defensive back said, I'm taking away the outside, the linebacker's taking away the inside, Russell rolls out, and in essence, my belief, is the action of Russell rolling out caused that linebacker basically to take two steps up, giving, in essence, Doug the ability to make that real shifty little subtle juke inside and set the whole thing up. So if they don't move that pocket and we have, whatever, Peyton Manning as quarterback and they're not really worried about him running anywhere, it doesn't make all that stuff work. And yes, in my belief, they have this amazing ability to have this high stakes one. This hopefully will work out, and if it doesn't, it looks really bad.
I feel like they have a lot of confidence in themselves to execute in those situations.
There's some hubris there. And the backside, too, is you're going to get guys.
Well-founded hubris, though.
Hell yeah, it is. The backside's going to have drag routes that come back over, and so those will be the guys that have worked their way past the goalpost and will be there. But
it gets real messy.
It gets really messy. There's a lot of garbage and trash in the middle of the field, and you don't want to make that throw.
Crazy thing. The football game last night. No great love for Alabama. Mm-hmm. Man, those guys will take insane risks at insane moments. And darn it, if those things don't work out a lot of times, I don't know how they get their guys to execute it. Mm-hmm. And it's just crazy.
You're a financial advisor. I mean,
so is he.
You're a financial advisor.
It's Oprah time. We all got couches.
Timing is as big as the decision, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you try an onside kick, right?
Yeah.
Stay with Alabama. You try an onside kick at any point. It doesn't matter. But when you are so trained to look for one key and it just happens to happen after a big momentum swinging touchdown, mm-hmm. you know, that's how you take the right move and make it, you know, get exponential returns on it instead of just decent returns on a good play. And I think timing is everything. And I think that the series of events, I mean, really, Seattle won that game on four plays. They won that game on the crazy Russell Wilson. Yeah. Like, there was this stretch. The Russell Wilson crazy runaround throw to Lockett, the touchdown, the fumble, the Jermaine Kearse catch to set up the field goal. And that was it for the Seahawks offensive production. Yep. Was 4 minutes right there. That was it. That was all of it. So that timing, I think, was so important and probably affects the psyche of play calling and all of that when you feel like, uh-oh, other teams had a whole bunch of momentum.
Well,
if you ask, I bet you if you ask Nick Saban, too, do you think he wanted an onside kick? Probably not.
No.
Right.
But with where they were in the game, he probably, I mean, literally, it probably went down like, hey, you want to do it? yeah, it would probably work.
Yeah.
It's a risk.
And it could just be that everyone is so keyed in that, hey, if the furthest guy to either side is two steps from the hash marks or in, mm-hmm. we're doing this. And I trust my kicker to put the ball right there. Yeah. And that's what happened. There was just no one over there to field it.
Well, think back to the Super Bowl Sean Payton. That's exactly where I was going. Where at halftime, going into halftime, he told them we were opening off a surprise onside. And they went after Hank Basket or the guy that married the Playboy girl, whatever. And they went. They had isolated him earlier in the game, and from study that if they were going to do a surprise onside, that's who they were going after. Think back to the field goal in which Richard Sherman almost blocked. You talk about timing. Mm. Mm-hmm. Pete Carroll had said that they had seen something in film in which they had a key for when Richard could go, and it wasn't watching the ball; it was watching something that one of the other players from the Vikings was doing. When Blair went to kick that game, the attempted game-winning field goal, Pete had been warned by the official that Richard was really close to getting a penalty, and so they pulled off of, we're not going to use that timing mechanism. Yeah. We just believe that there's enough stuff.
And Richard Sherman missed blocking that field goal. I mean, I could not see space in between his hand and that ball.
Yeah, and so you talk about timing. He had a timing mechanism there that they said, you know what, at this point, we can't take the risk of a penalty and giving him a second field goal attempt.
On a impactful but less big stage, I get as frustrated as anybody when Michael Bennett is offsides in the neutral zone.
Sure.
But for the stuff he does, when he does the magic that he does, guessing snap counts and anticipating linemen pulling and all that sort of stuff, it drives me crazy when he's in the neutral zone. But for the amount of good stuff that happens when he does Michael Bennett shenanigans and the amount of just havoc that it wreaks.
Well, and he's rushing generally. He's trying to beat a guy inside as opposed to outside. He's working. I mean, you guys know this as well as anyone.
Yep.
If you as a tackle got a guy lining up on your inside shoulder, mm-hmm. the things that he can do to you are limited, right? Yep. So that ability to guess becomes huge. Outside, he's got room to do all kinds of stuff.
And he's doing stuff, too, where he might line up outside, but he guesses the snap count, and he's fast enough, if I weigh 360, that he can come from outside and cross my face.
Yeah. Well, who's the DN? And I don't remember the DN that did the... He comes off the left tackle, starts going with a spin move, stops a spin move mid, and then cuts underneath. Like, the athletic, the freakish ability of these guys is insane at every level. And then you get somebody like a Michael Bennett or an Earl Thomas or a Cam Chancellor or Richard Sherman that is just that much better than everybody.
You were talking about the high risk and high reward thing.
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking about stuff right now that's high risk, high reward. Michael Bennett gets himself one or two offside or, you know, neutral zone infractions, you know, one a game on average or 0.7 a game on average or something. It's not because he's an idiot. It's because he's doing stuff that gives him significant advantages when he does it right.
Well, and being a center, there are things that we all do, just like batters do, just like fighters do. I mean, when Rashad Evans knocked out Chuck Liddell to win the belt and to basically start the downward slide of Chuck Liddell, who was the best light heavyweight in MMA in the world at the time. I mean, he had nuclear power in both hands. They saw Jackson's camp saw something that Chuck would bite his mouthpiece and crinkle his nose right before he was going to throw an overhand right. So it's through that study. Michael Bennett sees things. He's not just going because he wants to go. He has studied enough film to do that. And one of the things that as a center I would do is you get the referees on the sides that are quite a ways away. I mean, you figure a football field's 53 yards wide. They can't see me do this to a football, but I can do this to a football and not snap it and literally just grab it harder. And that D lineman over me is probably watching my hand more than he's watching the ball. You can do little things to mess with D linemen.
So you time that with a hard count.
You time that with a hard count, and you're gonna get somebody to jump off sides. And I always knew that if we needed to get something, we were going on two. On one, I could probably do that and maybe get a guy to jump. Not all the time, but you might be able to get somebody to jump. So there are little things you can do within that game, and he picks up on those things. And offensive linemen are smart to realize he's picking up on this, so I'm going to deke him, and it will cost them 5 yards. Or, going back to Green Bay game, it'll cost a touchdown because it's a free play.
Yeah. Going into transitioning, looking forward into this Carolina game, because really, I mean, that's what matters now, right?
Mm-hmm.
they're 15-1. There's only a handful of teams ever win 15 games in a regular season. Weak schedule. There's no way around it. But what do you do when you're given a weak schedule? You go out and you beat everybody, right? That's what they've done. They beat everybody they played. Their only loss was to a team they beat earlier in the season. When you look at the Panthers, and feel free to chime in with either of you guys. When you look at the Panthers versus the Seahawks, what is the matchup that worries you the most?
The matchup that worries me the most is probably our receivers versus their linebackers and secondary, because their linebackers are so good that they're good against the run, they're good against the pass. They're just flat freaking good. I mean, for your Shaq Thompson, Thomas Davis, and Luke Kuechly, there might not be a better linebacking core in the NFL. They are all fast. They all tackle well. That is a really good team, and they play base solid defense. The thing that gives me hope in the passing game is they're under the third quarterback. They signed Cortland Finnegan off of the streets. They're down a safety. That gives me hope. But those linebackers are really, really good, and linebackers can have something to do with the run game, and they have something to do with the pass game. I'll be really interested to see how our O-line blocks, too. We were starting Drew Nowak earlier in the season during this time. We have seemed to have righted the ship quite a bit. But yeah, their linebackers around the field are what concern me more than anything.
I was just going to go with a softball. I just hope they can deal with Greg Olsen, all right? I mean, to me, that's
Greg Olsen does not get enough credit for how good of a football player that he is.
Good.
He's really,
good.
Really good at football. Like everything. I mean, he's Jason Witten, right?
Yeah.
I mean, he is. He's that guy that will just give you. He will do everything right every single play.
And how did the Bears ever let him go?
That's
honestly
amazing.
You have a tight end like that. That is somebody you hold like a Jason Witten forever. That is a awesome stock. That is a chevron that you literally hold forever, and you hold for 40 years and you give to your grandkids type stuff. Greg Olsen is a phenomenal tight end.
Yeah. So how do you defend Greg Olsen? Because we saw his fourth quarter the first time around. Now maybe that was communication issues, but the tight end seam route has been Seattle's worst play this year. So how do you stop the Cam Newton Greg Olsen connection?
Well, I think for me, I would hope it's. I think we do our best on Greg Olsen, and then we have to be able to pressure Cam Newton.
You know, when you say your best, I mean, are you moving Richard Sherman in on Greg?
It was like when Jimmy Graham came in, and what they basically covered Jimmy Graham with KJ Wright. Mm-hmm. You have to have probably your linebacker or Cam Chancellor play an exceptionally good football game. And I think the pass rush can really help him. Meaning that if they can pester, in a not sack Cam Newton, but basically get into his legs, get into his space. He's an arm thrower. You know, he's hard to sack, but at the same time, you can alter his mechanics. And we've got to get help for those guys, and we can't let him, you know, do Cam Newton things throwing the ball to Greg Olsen. That would be I think those guys have to play great, and then we have to help. We have to help him be uncomfortable when he throws the ball to Greg Olsen.
I think that for me, the most worrisome matchup in this game is honestly Cam Newton versus Seattle's red zone defense. You know, like we talked about, Seattle is fine with you getting yards between the 30s, right? Mm-hmm. But they trust their athleticism, their size, their scheme in a small field to do that. Cam Newton he's going to win the MVP, whether he deserves it or not, different conversation. But I do think that he is the finest red zone threat God's ever put on this earth. And 45 touchdowns from one guy this year, mm-hmm. right? I mean, what it takes to stop Cam Newton behind the line of scrimmage from making a successful play is a lot, because you're not tackling him with one guy. Mm-hmm. He can throw from any position. He had one of the greatest rushing seasons in NFL history for a quarterback this mm-hmm. year. And he's got, you know, Greg Olsen. And he's got Jonathan Stewart and Cameron Artis Payne and all of you guys. When these guys need short yardage to go, they get it. They get it at a really, really high rate. So what I want to know from you guys is how much of that is the product of them playing arguably the easiest schedule in the NFL this year, and how much of it is they are actually designed on purpose to be deadly efficient from 20 yards in, because they have been this year.
They are built, that team is built very similar to Seattle's, in which they don't beat themselves, they play solid defense, they keep it simple, and they make tackles. When you get in the red zone with Cam Newton, he is the ultimate weapon. They don't do a lot of stuff, but what they do it very well, and they can just hand the ball off, or Cam can pull it and run in and start celebrating. I think Seattle, when they played last time, they didn't have Bobby Wagner, and I think that's a huge thing for this game, because Bobby is unbelievably good at making the open field tackles.
The Seahawks were a very different team in week six.
Okay, so Jimmy Graham had 8 receptions for 140 yards. He's out of it. Ricardo Lockett was their second leading receiver with two catches for 43 yards and a touchdown. Chris Matthews had a reception. We had Marshawn Lynch was our leading rusher. Thomas Rawls had a rush for 8 yards. None of those guys are there. This is a very different team. Jermaine Kearse didn't have a catch. Doug Baldwin, I think, had 23 yards receiving. There was not – this is a completely different team, Seattle is, than when they faced them the first time. If Seattle can just do what they do and not beat themselves, not get behind the chains, not have the second and 15s, they're going to be in a really good position to win. This is going to be a close game. This is going to be a hard-fought game. But it's one of those games that Seattle could win. No doubt about it.
So, I mean, is Carolina just a product of their system? Are they the number one team in the NFC because of who they played or because of how they played?
This is a – I feel like it's a cop-out answer, but I would say both. I mean, the fact of the matter is NFL teams are really good.
Yep.
The bad teams are still really good. That being said, they are a really good team that played a lot of teams that were average or below average. And if you have an incredible amount of success against teams that are average or below average, momentum, belief, that stuff is really, really, really powerful. And with the fact that a lot of these teams, that 2% that you guys, that we always talk about, if you have that real strong belief, and you believe, if I'm the right tackler or the left guard, and I believe that Cam Newton can do anything, the funny part is you believe Cam Newton can do anything. Cam Newton starts to believe that Cam Newton can do anything.
Cam Newton has always believed that Cam Newton can do anything.
But what I'd also say is up until really this year, Cam Newton has not been able to do everything.
No, I agree.
Cam Newton did stupid stuff that hurt.
So what changed?
I think they had enough stuff go right for long enough, and he did superhuman things that for now, Cam Newton believes he can do everything.
Well, and does a car accident change your perspective in life? Maybe. Just like somebody getting cancer changes their perspective on life. Who knows? I mean, who knows what goes on inside the mind of Cam other than Cam wanting to celebrate Cam. Yeah. He is physically unlike anybody else that the NFL has ever seen, with that size, that a combination of size, speed, accuracy, and Carolina has
and the willingness to dive into a pile against a bunch of... That's the thing people don't talk about. They're like, oh, Cam Newton gets all these touchdowns and the celebration and whatever. Listen, if you are willing to dive at full speed into three defensive linemen, you can do what... You can sacrifice a chicken in the end zone afterwards for all I care.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think that that matters. There's a reason that other quarterbacks don't get rushing touchdowns, because either the willingness isn't there on the play call or on the quarterback.
Do you want Russell Wilson doing that?
Well, no.
To look at Cam Newton, I mean, he's basically just... He's Russell Wilson in a 6'5" body.
Yeah.
That, you know, he's just certainly not as well-spoken as Russell Wilson, doing his due diligence.
Yes.
If you remember that. He had to do his due diligence to protect this house. Still my favorite line of the season. But, the thing that lies dormant in Cam Newton, which I don't think lies dormant in Russell Wilson, because I don't believe it's there, is Cam Newton absolutely still has the ability, in my opinion, to completely frag out.
Sure.
And do stupid stuff. And I just... it's they all have it, but Cam Newton still has that ability.
Yeah, and horrible statistics going into the fourth quarter of that Hawks game.
So what do you do then? Right, okay, yeah, yeah. Talk about that for a second, because the splits between the first three quarters in that first game versus the fourth quarter were...
It's a momentum thing, and it's a belief thing.
Yeah.
It really is. If Seattle can get up on Carolina and force them to be a passing team, that plays in Seattle's favor. Absolutely. I think Seattle's run defense has gotten better later in the season than it was earlier this season. I think we've really seen a Tava Rubin come
into Carolina ran run. Against them.
Carolina moved it.
I think they had more rushing yards that game than any other team had against the Seahawks.
So it'll be very interesting to see what Seattle is able to do. And again, we know Seattle just does what Seattle does. They're not going to try to reinvent the wheel. They're going to be boring. They're going to be powerful. But they have the ability to stuff the run. They just held the leading rusher in the NFL in two games to, what, 60 yards, 70 yards?
But that's a very different run offense.
It's a very different run offense.
There's no threat of the quarterback keeping
it in that offense. But Seattle doesn't have to bring eight or nine guys into the box to stop the run.
Well, it's the back end of the defense is different. It was Kerry Williams. This was during the Kerry Williams experiment. That was going on. And I don't know. It's just I think we match up okay against them. I think we really do, and I think if the Seahawks do a good job of getting Cam Newton into a "this is happening to me again" situation, maybe he'll do great. And this is part of what Cam Newton needs. If he really is going to be a remarkably good quarterback, he's got to come and do this again and keep going. But also, I'm not quite sold on the fact yet that Cam Newton in that situation is going to do it. Maybe he will, maybe he won't. But our job is to put him in that situation. Or even better, get it so out of hand that he doesn't even get a chance to be in that situation.
Panthers, for all of their defensive talent and acumen, they gave up a lot of points in the back half of this season.
Sure.
There were a lot of touchdowns scored on that team that hasn't been scored in years past. Yeah. And for as incredible as Josh Norman has been, and Josh Norman has been incredible. Yeah. Josh Norman, I don't think, is going to be a huge factor in this game because statistically, he does not cover the slot. Seattle's Josh Norman's greatest value is his ability to at least neutralize your best receiver, right? Well, Seattle's best receiver is going to line up in the slot 90% of the time. And unless they are willing to move Josh Norman into the slot and put Courtland Finnegan out on Tyler Lockett or Kurtz.
Please.
Right.
Please.
Right, exactly.
Please. I would love to see the deep shots
exactly.
in non-zero degree weather to Tyler Lockett.
So I think that's going to be a really interesting thing is, do they let Finnegan try and cover Baldwin in the slot? Do they just go a little bit more zone and drop Kuechly? You know, that's going to be really interesting for me to see because, to me, the Seahawks just won a football game in which both teams were reduced to one dimension, and we're just going to out that one dimension you, and it worked out in Seattle's favor. Once you open up the playbook, the way the Seattle's been for the last 2.5 months has been the best offensive team in the NFL. Mm-hmm. And their only two down games were in absurd weather conditions. So assuming a decent track this weekend, to me, I don't see the Seahawks scoring less than 27 points in this game. Like, I think that Carolina's going to have to score a lot of points. And, yeah. And I'm not sure that I think Carolina will get theirs. I think they'll score 20 points in this game. But I think Seattle's going to score more. I think that the Seahawks offense, whether it's Christian Michael or Marshawn Lynch, what we're going to see is the full playbook, not the sliver of the playbook that you're reduced to in situations like we saw last week.
Well, I mean, think about it. Last time we played between Tyler Lockett, Jermaine Kearse, and Doug Baldwin, there was 23 yards of receptions. Luke Wilson had one catch for 16 yards. It's totally changed. We're getting Luke Wilson back, which I think is huge for this offense. This is huge. He is the guy that has enough speed that can run past linebackers and threaten the defense deep. His ability to threaten the defense deep allows the slot receivers and the outside guys to get more favorable matchups. So having him back is huge. I'm going to be really curious to see when adversity strikes both of these teams, how they overcome it. And we've seen Seattle overcome adversity over and over and over again. How does Carolina react when their season's on the line? because they haven't had their season on the line and have to come back yet. Yeah. They've had a cakewalk of their division. They had the number one seed, you know, not sewn up, but pretty well in
hand. Once they beat Green Bay, it was pretty sewn.
Yeah. So how do they do if they have some real adversity?
Yeah.
No, I this is just, there's good things afoot in this game for the Seahawks, I think. I think, heavens, if we get some sort of special teams touchdown, or we, for the love of Pete, have a defensive score of some sort. They've got weapons to take away some of our weapons, but in this case, we've got enough weapons that we should be able to have traction and make things work. I really do believe that. And like you say again, if they come out and handle us 30-14, then you know what? They are, schedule or not, they are as built.
You tip your hat.
This is a different group, a different team. The belief factor on the Seahawks. I talked about the belief factor on the Panthers side. Guess what? The Seahawks now have a different belief factor than they had it. Things were rocky. Things were going awry. Things were home or not. This is a little bit different crowd. I have also a suspicion in a locker room, you know, sometimes the football gods have things go a certain way, and I have a high degree of belief that they'll probably look at that as a collective and say, this is, assuming this goes the way we all hope it goes, that will be looked upon as, do you remember that time in Minnesota when that
went
that way? Right. Can you imagine? And can you imagine if the Seahawks come out and put a licking on the Panthers, what that sets up, what that creates?
Here's one thing I tweeted out after that game is, publicly, the Panthers will say it doesn't matter who won that game, but I promise you, they were hoping Walsh made that kick.
In a heartbeat.
Yeah. They don't want to face the Seahawks. I can't imagine they want to face the Seahawks.
I wouldn't say this against a lot of opponents, but we could – I mean, you can blow a lot of people out. We could blow this team out.
Yeah.
We absolutely could.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying it as like a – as a taking my Seahawks fanness out of it, seeing the matchups and how it works, and take Doug Baldwin away, we've got Tyler Lockett and Luke Wilson. Take Tyler Lockett away, we've got Doug Baldwin and Luke Wilson. You know, there's enough there that if things go right, it's a matchup that's functional – that we could, I'm not saying we will, but we could blow this team out.
And we literally haven't said Marshawn Lynch one time in this whole thing, and we might get one of the best running backs that the NFL has seen in the last decade back for this game. We don't know. Last week was frustrating as all get out, kind of deflating on Friday. But that is a very real possibility for this game. And you want to talk about that snowball effect of momentum and feel it and riding the wave.
Yep.
You get Marshawn back, there's a hell of a riding the wave for Seattle.
Can you imagine the deliciousness, just the deliciosity that could take place if we take it to Carolina, and God forbid Arizona loses. Not that I want to go to Green Bay, but just chaos, you know, of the way that it was supposed to go, and then just what could come to pass. I mean, it's what an amazing opportunity.
I think for me, that win in Arizona kind of reopened my eyes to what this team can be, right? Because basically all we had seen is them beat bad teams or decent teams, the backup quarterbacks, and the Steelers. That's all we had before. But to see them not only go out and beat what I think is the best team in the NFL, but beat them at their place, with home field advantage on the line,
and beat them by done.
Yeah, right.
Done, I mean, at to halftime.
Just yes, exactly. I think that shows me that this team at their best can beat anybody, and it's going to be really interesting. You mentioned how important it is for KJ Wright and Cam Chancellor to have a game, you know, a good game in this one. I can't remember KJ Wright. Cam Chancellor did not have a good game against the Panthers. Last time I played, it was only his third game back. Yep. Fourth game back. The single greatest individual defensive game I have ever seen by a Seahawk in my lifetime was this week, last year, these two teams, when Cam Chancellor came as close to single-handedly winning a playoff football game as any strong safety ever has. I mean, he changed everything that game. Yep. So, It's crazy to think, but we've only seen great Cam Chancellor in glimpses this year. Yeah. It is, I think, supremely important. I agree with your point earlier that Cam Chancellor be great Cam Chancellor in this game, in coverage, in run support. And you might just need to steal a touchdown. How long has it been since the Seahawks had the Bengals game? Mm-hmm. Since they had defensive or special teams touchdown? So, I mean, In a sense, they're overdue. Listen, we can keep going for a long time, but I know that all you out there have things to get to. So I want to thank you for tuning in to another week of Cigar Thoughts. We're going to have another one next week for you. Hopefully, we'll have these two guys back along with Brent and Danny. So for Isaac Williams, Matt Nichols, I'm Jackson Bevins from FieldGoals.com. Big thanks to Joel Litwin for making us look and sound so good, putting in the time to edit for us. You can find this on podcasts. Find the podcast on iTunes through the Field Goals feed, and we'll catch you guys next week, because the way things played out on Sunday means we get at least one more week of this. So until then, we'll catch you.